Good evening, everyone. Tonight's session will be dedicated in memory of the late, great Moshe Arends, who passed away, three-time defense minister of Israel, a great hero of our people. So our topic for tonight will be the fate of the territories, of the administered or occupied territories after the Six-Day War. As we mentioned last time, on June 19, 1967, the cabinet met and decided that in exchange for full peace with Syria and Egypt, the government of Israel would be willing to relinquish control over the Golan Heights and the Sinai Desert in their entirety, meaning go back to the June 4, 67 borders, which is a very gracious thing on the part of Israel to return to the old borders after a victorious war. But when it came to the West Bank and Gaza, there was no consensus within the cabinet, which is no surprise, because after all, that's historic Eretz Yisrael, and this cabinet ran the gamut from fairly far-left characters in the Mapam all the way to Menachem Begin and Gachal. And so you're going to have different ideas about what to do, especially with the West Bank and its historic Jewish connections. Gaza will remain a bone in the throat of Israel, in the words of Levi Eshkol. So less concern about retaining Gaza long term because of some devotion to it, but the West Bank, yes.
It was way before Gush Emunim.
Oh, way before. We're not going to discuss Gush Emunim until after the Yom Kippur War, 1974-75. So what are the various attitudes? Well, let's go from the right and move our way to the left. Actually, we'll do the right and the left and then the creamy middle. So the right, Menachem Begin's Gachal, representing the old Chayrut Party, and for that matter, people who were not in Chayrut, but who had past associations, for that matter, with Lehi, in the pre-state era, had always been clamoring for the conquest of the West Bank and had thought that the 1948 War of Independence was not a real success. It was a success insofar as there's a Jewish state called the Medinat Yisrael, but it was not a success territorially speaking because the heartland of Eretz Yisrael was not under Jewish control. This was not something that most people were thinking about throughout the 1950s and early 60s. Israel just existed in, you know, minimal borders, and life moved on, and you don't focus on what you don't have and what seems to be unattainable. But there were those who, although at that time, had their eye on the prize and wondered one day what would be if we could gain control of the West Bank. Added to this group of people who were believers all through and through were those who, upon the conquest of the West Bank, had an epiphany and said, hey, this is a great thing. We should never leave. Ever. Ever. This is the Greater Land of Israel movement. And the Greater Land of Israel movement, Eretz Yisrael HaShlema, attracted adherents from all across the political spectrum, not just from the right, but also from the center and even from the left. But truth be told, on the left side of the aisle, there were those who believed in a full Eretz Yisrael and who had opposed partition, namely those to the left of the Mapai, the Achdut HaAvodah, and even the Mapam. In the old days, in 1948, had opposed the partition plan and had wanted the full conquest of Eretz Yisrael. It didn't work out that way, and they sort of dropped the subject, but having conquered it, now is an opportunity to settle it in its entirety and never give it up again. This was the view of Yitzhak Tabenkin, who was the chief ideologue of faction B of the Mapai, the Achdut HaAvodah faction. So you have all across the political map people who favored retaining the territories. Now, what did they say was going to happen to the Arab population there? Well, they don't say much, because after all, people have ideas of what they like. They don't focus on what is problematic and what throws a wrench into the whole thing. There really was no good solution for the Arabs of the territories. Demographically, it would be a problem for the state of Israel to absorb them. So the Eretz Yisrael,
how many Arabs were there?
There were approximately 250,000 in Gaza, most of them refugees from the 48 war, and approximately 650,000 in the West Bank. So we're talking roughly 900,000. And at the time, Israel had a Jewish population of about 2.5 million.
And did any Arabs flee?
Yes, between 200,000 and 250,000 fled across the bridges to Jordan, and some of them were allowed back, although not all those who fled were interested in coming back even when the opportunity presented itself. Unlike in 48, when refugees could not return, and it was not their choice, they were stuck, Moshe Dayan quickly reversed policy in July, of, late June and July of 67, and gave an opportunity for those who had fled to immediately return.
And they could go back to their homes?
Yes, because their homes were not going to be expropriated for Jewish purposes. This was not going to be, Israel didn't need to settle 1 million refugees from the Arab countries like it did in 1949, and therefore have a need for Arab housing stock. This was just an unexpected war. People left, let people return. Okay, so now let's go to the far left. On the very, very far left, of course, you have the communists and the anti-Zionist crowd, among the Jews I'm talking about, and certainly among Israeli Arabs. And they would argue that Israel has to return to the pre-67 borders because this was an illegitimate war of conquest, and no change of the borders is at all justified. Of course, that point of view will be summarily dismissed by anyone within the Zionist camp, but such views do exist, and it's what the Soviet Union was clamoring for. So it's not surprising that Raqqa and Maki would make such demands on the Israeli government. Those were ignored.
I can't remember, but in the history of Western civilization, even beforehand, when somebody won a war, did they give land back? Or
no.
Is this the first time
it's been broached? It's pretty close to it. There's very little precedent for this. So the major left-wing point of view was that of David Ben-Gurion, who, remember, is largely out of politics, not out of politics, but out of government, and whose view doesn't matter all that much, and who said that the territories are an opportunity for peaceful negotiations with the Arab states, and that everything can be returned except for the city of Jerusalem, which shall remain united under Israeli rule. The doves in the government, notably Pinchas Sapir, the finance minister, and Abba Ibn, the foreign minister, favored that view. This view would not have an opportunity to succeed because it requires a willing partner, and there was no willing partner. The other side of the aisle, namely the Arab states, adopted the three no's of Khartoum: no negotiations, no recognition, and no peace. So it's a moot point. But the fact that leading figures in and out of government favored a complete withdrawal under peaceful conditions goes to show you that not everyone was so enamored with the idea of Eretz Yisrael HaShleima, that these are Arab territories. Yes, they're historically Jewish territories, but they have a significant Arab population, which is unwanted, and a need for a diplomatic arrangement, and not to alienate the superpowers who don't want to see an expansionist Israel. Yeah.
To follow up on the previous question, was there ever a discussion within the government where the land for peace was the only strategy or the only right strategy?
Yes, there were those who, and I'm going to mention it now, those who believed that there should not necessarily be negotiations with the Arab states, but rather unilateral Israeli action in the territories combined with a measure of autonomy granted to the population there, so that it's not full annexation, but it's also not land for peace. That's the Moshe Dayan approach. Let's discuss that now. So, yeah.
Concerning the quickness of the war and the success of the war, was there ever discussion of how miraculous the war was?
Sure.
People in government.
I'm sure privately, in conversations that are not recorded for posterity, I would tend to think that many of them made such comments. But I can't cite for you anyone in particular. All right.
I mean, the truth be said, aside from Beit Lechem and Hebron, I don't think anybody really had such a strong attachment, you know, to the West Bank.
The archaeologists did.
That was the money.
Okay, so let's discuss Dayan's approach. Now, Moshe Dayan, who is the defense minister and will remain in that position until 1974, and as the defense minister is directly responsible for administering the territories, he gets to appoint all the governors and his decisions rule the day. His attitude was, of course, a contradictory one, since everything about Moshe Dayan was one big contradiction. His famous line was, "I'm waiting for the phone to ring." Now, what does "I'm waiting for the phone to ring" actually mean? Well, it means that in theory, if King Hussein were willing to negotiate over the fate of the West Bank, that he would find King Hussein to be the appropriate partner in those discussions, more so than anyone else, meaning local Palestinian leaders or the PLO, for that matter, which was in its infancy under Ahmed Shoukairi, not yet under Yasser Arafat. Arafat would take over the PLO about 2 years later, in 1969. So Dayan, on the one hand, says, "I'm waiting for the phone to ring." On the other hand, he has an idea of what he wants to see happen in the West Bank. He doesn't really believe that peace is in the offing anytime soon. So he thinks that Israel is going to have long-term control over the West Bank. How do you do that? Well, on the one hand, he says we should not interfere too much in the lives of the residents, the Arab residents of the territories. They should be able to be born, live, raise a family, and die without ever seeing an Israeli bureaucrat. He said it's bad enough that we Israelis have to deal with the Israeli bureaucracy. We shouldn't impose that upon the Goyim. That was his humorous line. But what he meant was that, and he clarified this later, that the system in the West Bank should not be that of a Soviet commissar, or for that matter, a British colonial approach. Neither one or the other. Now, what are those two approaches? The Soviet commissar approach is that at every level of government, at every level of life, the bureaucracy intrudes upon you, and there are spies watching your every move who are reporting back to some higher authority, and that the Israelis, the Yahuds, the Jews will know all the little details, the inglorious details of Palestinian life in the territories, with spies ratting on everyone. That he doesn't want. The British approach was that the local population runs all the mundane affairs, but at the very top, the colonial power makes all the real decisions. He doesn't want that either. He wants some Israeli input in the affairs of the territories, but without the residents having to feel it, and to have to feel it as being onerous and restrictive upon their living conditions, which is the great complaint that the Palestinians have today, that life is too difficult because you can't move, you can't get permits for things, that Israel runs everything with an iron fist. Well, that's what he wants vis-a-vis the Arab population. But what about the Jewish presence or the Israeli presence in the territories? So he said we have to have military installations and possibly even civilian/military installations all along the highlands, the ridge in Judea and Samaria, near but not in the major cities like Jenin, Nablus, Ramallah, okay, the whole spine of the territories. So you have to have military installations to entrench the presence of Israel there, and even possibly civilians. He also says you should allow Israeli land purchases of Arab land, private land purchases. For what purpose? For whatever you want. You want to build a settlement? You want to have an industrial zone? Whatever it is, but Arabs should be able to sell land to Jews. Now, if an Arab sells land to Jews today, what happens to them? It's a big problem for them. But in Dayan's approach, 52 years ago, that should not be a big sin, chet gadol. It should be de rigueur. It should happen all the time. Nothing wrong with it. And he wanted industrial development in the territories with employment for Palestinians, but with the production owned by Israelis, so that this is an opportunity to exploit Arab labor. This is all his ideas. What about the fate of the Palestinians in terms of their relationship with the wider Arab world? So, yeah.
At this point, they're not Palestinians, right? That terminology does not...
No, they're the Arabs of the territories.
When do they start to be called Palestinians?
It became a common practice by the late 60s, and Israel, or especially Golda Meir, fought back rhetorically against this in denying the existence of a Palestinian people or a Palestinian nationhood. Well, they were Jordanian citizens. They're Jordanian passport holders. They've been Jordanian citizens for 19 years. They would remain Jordanian citizens up until 1988, when King Hussein, 87, when King Hussein abdicates responsibility for the territories. It's a complicated matter when these people no longer regarded themselves as having a connection to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Yeah.
The transition into establishing settlements for strategic purposes,
yeah,
to have a breathing space in case of a future war, an early warning system,
yeah,
it was a Sharon plan after the Yom Kippur War.
So Sharon was a believer in security-based settlements as opposed to ideologically-based settlements, because he wasn't really a right-wing ideologue, as is seen from his eventual withdrawal from Gaza and the notion of Kadima breaking away from the Likud. And there would be many people who agreed with him. Dayan's approach was similar but not the same, in that having an Israeli presence in the Arab heartland was for security purposes and also to make it very difficult to withdraw. in the long run, knowing that there'd be doves who would want to withdraw.
But who actually wasn't there the day or a few days after the war a proposal that we are prepared to give everything back provided we give.
Yes, yes, there was a very conciliatory approach right after the war. So now, Dayan's approach did not go over well with the rest of the Mapai / labor establishment. And as the years went on, 68, 69, 70, there would be bitter complaints about Dayan's approach. The most significant complaint came from Pinchas Sapir, the finance minister, who said that this is antithetical to Zionism. That what is Zionism? Zionism is a Jewish state in part of Eretz Yisrael that is not going to include a heavy dose of Arab citizens and is not going to be based upon exploiting the labor of an ethnic underclass, a non-Jewish ethnic underclass.
That's like J Street.
But rather, Jewish labor, Avodah Ivrit, was the main focus of the early Aliyot in the pre-state era, Hebrew labor. And what's going to happen in Dayan's approach, and in fact what does happen, Arabs from the territories flood across the Green Line, which doesn't exist anymore, and become the menial laborers in pre-67 Israel. So that they're fixing the cars and building the apartment buildings, and the Jews go into the white-collar professions. And that wasn't what Israel was supposed to be about. Israel was supposed to be about Jews getting their hands dirty, not relying upon Arabs doing the dirty work. So he didn't like that, and he didn't like the demographic imbalance. Golda Meir would also complain about this and say that she doesn't want to have to wake up every morning and look at the birth vital statistics and see who had more babies, the Jews or the Gentiles. That pre-67 Israel was solidly Jewish. Post-67 Israel, if you include the territories and swallow them up, with or without a formal annexation, means that there are going to be a lot of Arabs who've come very close to balancing out demographically with the Jews. And you have to worry about who's going to have the upper hand. And she doesn't want to live in a country like that. And I don't blame her. Okay, so that was the criticism, the Dayan approach, of a creeping annexation. A creeping annexation. Dayan didn't call it annexation. He called it functional compromise as opposed to territorial compromise. Functional in that, at the local level, Arab residents will determine their own affairs. They'll elect their own mayors who collects the garbage. But the big issues will be decided by Israel in terms of security and diplomacy. Yeah.
At the very end of the war,
well, I mentioned last week that Yigal Yadin, when he encouraged the conquest of Hebron on day 3 of the war, was told by Eshkol, but who needs all those Arabs? And his response was, they'll run away to the desert. And that didn't happen. There was no mass flight. There were some, of course, who run away, as it is always the case in wartime, but there was no mass flight of this.
No.
Well, Meir Kahana is busy protesting for Soviet Jewry and getting into fist fights in Brooklyn in 1967. He's not even in Israel yet.
After the war, there was a lot of going back and forth between the Israelis and the Arabs between different territories. The Israelis had freedom to roam around.
Okay, so let's discuss that. What was the policy on human movement over old borders? So the original policy was, the first few weeks after the war, that the Jordan River would be closed, and that anyone who attempted to come back from the East Bank to the West Bank would be either shot or captured. Dayan reconsidered that about 3 weeks after the war ended, and by July 1st, that was no longer the policy, but rather the bridges over the Jordan, which had been destroyed, were rebuilt, and there was a so-called the open bridges policy, that anyone from the East Bank could go to the West Bank and West Bank to the East Bank, because the economy of the West Bank was tied to the rest of the Jordanian state and the Arab world, and to shut them off would mean to have a collapse of the economy. Now, true, the West Bank would then be linked to Israel, but that takes time to develop. So there was an open border at the bridge. There's an open border at the old Green Line, which was never even a line. It was just a fiction. So Arabs can go over for employment purposes, and Jews can go over the line to roam around, to shop, to be a tourist.
In
Hebron. Okay, good. So you can go wherever you like. All right. Now let's get to the plan which ultimately wins the day, at least for a decade. And you have the map in front of you. This is the Alon plan. So Yigal Alon, who was the Minister of Labor, and who had wanted to be the Defense Minister, but who lost out to Moshe Dayan in the political machinations of late May, early June 1967, he comes up with an idea. I ran out of copies. You'll have to share. Okay. So his point of view, if you remember, Alon was Achdut HaAvodah. Alon was in favor of Greater Israel. Alon believed that the great sin of 1948 was not conquering the West Bank, which he was willing as a commander to go ahead and do if Ben-Gurion gave the order. So he comes from a left faction of the labor branch of Zionism that wanted all of Eretz Yisrael. Well, after the Six-Day War, you have all of Eretz Yisrael. But he comes to realize very quickly there are too many Arabs, and this is not realistic. So there needs to be some solution that involves territorial compromise, not Dayan's bogus functional compromise, which was regarded by many as apartheid. And by the way, that word was used in the late 60s. Don't think it's just the anti-Zionists or anti-Semites today. It was used 50 years ago by Jews, by good Israelis, criticizing Dayan's approach. Okay. Alon's approach was the following. We want territory. It's our homeland. It's our national homeland, and we'll take as much as we can get away with. But what can we get away with? What is reasonable? So, what's reasonable is you take those areas that are empty, number one, because, I mean, if there are no Arabs there, the whole problem is not the occupation of land. It's the occupation of people. So if there are no people, it's ours. Second point, you have to have a defensive border to protect against a war with the Arab states. The concern is not so much the Palestinian population and terrorism, which would be a big issue in the 70s in the PLO, but the issue is war with the Arab states. So create a defensive border that will prevent that. Thirdly, expanding the Jerusalem corridor so that the capital of Israel is both a united one with the historic holy places and not cut off from the coast, which had been a problem ever since 1947. And lastly, make it possible for this map, however it's going to shape up, to allow for territorial contiguity between like-minded sections, between similar sections that might not be really connected. So you have to create somehow connections between Arab and Arab and Jew and Jew. Now let's take a look at the map. So the yellow would go to the Jordanians, and the orange, the darker color, goes to Israel. When I say the Jordanians, I say that only because, in the beginning at least, Alon assumed that the Hashemite kingdom would be willing to make a peace deal. He recognized at some point that King Hussein was unable to do that, and this arrangement is not going forward because Hussein is very weak. I mean, he was so weak that he was almost toppled in 1970, and if not for Israeli intervention, he would have died. Black September, which we'll discuss next week. So, well, let's look at the map. On the West Bank, the big chunk of it is in Samaria, and it's in the yellow. Why is it in yellow? It's going to go to the Arabs. What's there? Jenin, Nablus, Ramallah, Tulkarim, Kalkilia. Why do they call it Kalkilia? Because they'll kill you. It's an old joke. So there is no attempt made to do something that other Israeli leaders had spoken about. Look at this map. What doesn't happen in this map? There's no expansion of the waste of Israel. Even the Abba Ibans of the world and the Doves had long complained about the Auschwitz borders, that Israel was too narrow at the waist, and you need to expand it beyond the 9 or 11 miles, whatever it is. Well, the argument that this is dangerous, that we're under threat of genocide, of destruction, in such small, narrow borders. So he doesn't do anything about that.
Wait. Didn't he provide for demilitarization?
Yes, you were going to see, yeah, but in terms of annexation of territory and the placement of Jews there, this plan does not call for that. And the very simple reason why, because right over the Green Line is a fair amount of Arab population. Today there are plenty of settlements there, but it's interwoven with a lot of Arabs. It's a problem. That's why the fence, you know, has a twist, a lot of twists and turns. It's not a straight line by any stretch. Okay, so the Sumerian highlands and even the Sumerian drop down to the coastal plain is in Arab hands.
How come they left the latrine bulge?
But, no, we're going to. I'll explain. So now, the Jordan River Valley in the north is taken by Israel. For what purpose does this serve? So three things. One, the opportunity to put settlements there. I mean, after all, it's empty. There are very few people who live there. And we want Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the settlement of the land of Israel. Therefore, if you can grab it, grab it. Secondly, it allows for a line of defense against a possible invasion from the east. Which armies are in the east?
Iraq.
The Jordanians were never much of a real threat. And so long as the Hashemites are in control, and especially after the Six-Day War where they've been bludgeoned, they're not really, Israel's not really worried about a Jordanian invasion. However, Iraq was a formidable military force and had participated in several of the previous wars, and you want to have a line of defense that is at the river, at a natural barrier. The third consideration is a desire to break up the East Bank from the West Bank so that there is some presence of Israel in between, that you don't have mass movement of military personnel and materiel to the old green line. Remember, the old green line is going to remain an international border. You're just a few miles from the major cities of Israel, so it's not just preventing an invasion, it's a block that separates this from this, and it would serve a useful purpose. Okay, now let's go further south. What do we see in the Judean region, or in the Jerusalem corridor?
Before you get to the real place, is almost stuck out there by itself.
Okay, let me explain.
The map is not correct.
Lamalo?
Because Jericho is not where it shows you. It's right above Yamamela.
Correct. It's a bad map. It is a bad map. You're right. But the idea was that there would be a corridor that extended from the Sumerian highlands that would go behind the city of Jerusalem and go through Jericho, with Jericho remaining under Arab control, and bridges over the Jordan River into Transjordan, so that there was territorial contiguity between the East Bank and what was part of the West Bank that would remain in Jordan. Now let's go to south of that line. The Jerusalem corridor is going to be expanded in the north and in the south. In the north, the Latrun Bulge will become part of Israel. This was the easiest thing to guarantee, because remember, the Latrun Bulge was actually not even part of Jordan. It was demilitarized for the most part. It was a no man's land in between pre-67 Israel and Jordan. So taking that permanently is diplomatically less difficult than taking something that belonged to another country. But he wants to take even more than that and create neighborhoods north of the Green Line, all the way stretching towards West Jerusalem, which is what ultimately happens, and you have that to this day. You have a significant number of Israeli settlements north of Yerushalayim and extending south of Road 443. Then the city of Jerusalem, of course, will be united under Israeli control, and the Judean desert will remain under Israeli control. So everything south of Ma'ale Adumim, Israel. What about Gush Etzion? So the Jerusalem corridor has expanded southward to include Gush Etzion for two reasons. One, you want to expand the Jerusalem corridor, make sure it's not a lonely outpost. Two, because there are historic connections. Remember, psychologically, the Jews suffered terribly when Gush Etzion fell, and everybody was slaughtered to death and mutilated. It was the most horrific atrocity committed against the Jews in the 48 war was what happened to the last stragglers in Gush Etzion on the day that independence was declared. So it needs to be rebuilt. This is a mitzvah taseh d'oraita for modern Zionism to rebuild Gush Etzion. Okay. Let's see. So now that leaves a problem, because the Judean highlands, which are heavily Arab, are of course going to go to the Jordanians. So that's everything to the west of Hebron and to the north and to the south of Hebron. But you end up having Bethlehem being slightly cut off, like an enclave, north of Beit Lechem, on the one side, surrounded by surrounded on the left side to the west by an Israeli Gush Etzion, and to the right side an Israeli Judean desert. But it is connected to Hebron. And why would Beit Lechem be given over to the Arabs? Because it's a big Arab city, and you don't want it. If you're a Zionist, you don't want a big Arab city under Israeli control.
Isn't it mostly Christian then?
Yes, but even Christians aren't Jewish. No, I'm saying today it's hardly Christian at all.
No, I know that.
The Muslims kicked out the Christians and did horrible things to them. But and there would be a theory that the Christians of the West Bank would be better partners in settling the grand issues than would be the Muslim residents of the West Bank. As it turned out, that wasn't even really true. It was a havamina, as they say in Talmudic discourse, but it wasn't really true. The Christians and the Muslims were almost equally disdainful of Israeli control, and many of the great Palestinian freedom fighters, or we would call terrorists, were Christian. Dr. George Habash, okay, the worst of the worst. Yeah.
Against the Jews, they're
anti-Semites.
They're Greek Orthodox.
Right.
I hear them.
Yeah.
In the Greek radio programs, they spout forth the worst.
I know. Listen, the Patriarchate of Jerusalem has said horrible things. So, now, what was Alon's policy towards the holy places? He was not necessarily such a devotee of the Mekomot HaKadoshim, of the holy places. And so Kever Rachel didn't mean all that much to him. Therefore, it was not included in Israel under his plan. Today, Kever Rachel is a lonely outpost of Israel, and right behind it is Area A of the Palestinian Authority. But he didn't necessarily envision that. He also did not envision Hebron being under Israeli rule. If we look at this map, he favored Kiryat Arba, but not Hebron. And he made a big distinction. He did not view Kiryat Arba, the building of Kiryat Arba, as an adjunct to the holy city of Hebron. Rather, he viewed Kiryat Arba as the westernmost outpost of an Israeli Judean desert, with Hebron being over the line, Arab city over the line. Yes, he may have been willing to negotiate the fate of the Marat HaMachpelah and have a little bit of an area carved out, but it wasn't important to him. What mattered was Israel will settle the Judean desert up until an international frontier, a newly created one, and beyond it, even though it's a holy place, Arabs, let them have it. Yeah.
A little confusion. When did this plan be proposed? And because Kiryat Arba didn't exist right after the Six-Day War.
Understood.
And Mal El Dumim didn't exist after the war.
This map was not from 1968. This is map was from the internet from 2000 or whatever. It has place names that are not relevant, and it's geographically a little bit off. Huh?
The core is there too.
Now, yeah. So
yeah. When was Alon's plan?
He began proposing it late in 67, and it remained unofficial government policy up until Menachem Begin was elected. However, there would be violations of this policy, as we'll see in a few weeks, beginning with Sebastia in 1975, when the Gush Emunim crowd wants to have civilian settlement in heavily Arab areas, knowing this is against labor policy, and they'll have help from unlikely sources, notably Shimon Peres.
Yeah. I just don't follow this. If you take a look in the northern half,
yeah,
you have the annexed portion right by the Jordan River.
Yeah.
Then you have the yellow area.
Yeah.
And you have the gray area, which is existing Israel.
Yeah.
Right? Doesn't it seem to just bifurcate the whole country over there?
Yes.
And that doesn't seem to be practical.
Well, we'll see how it becomes practical with bypass roads. So let's now go to the southern end.
One quick question.
Yeah.
Said that the Palestinians did not identify as Palestinians till, you know, after 67.
Well, it depends who. Some did before.
How did they how did they identify from 20 through 48, the Arabs?
Arabs. Arabs. The Arab people. The Arabs of Palestine. The Palestinian usually meant the Jew in pre-48, 20s, 30s, early 40s. The Arabs are just Arabs. Arabs. So, in the southern reaches of the West Bank, Alon proposed the annexation of that last little sliver on the bottom for security reasons. There could be military installations there that he wanted to put. What about Gaza? So Gaza's an interesting question, because on the one hand, Jordan had no connection to Gaza. It was under Egyptian control. And the thinking was that under a peace agreement with Egypt, Gaza would not go back to the Egyptian rule. After all, their rule over Gaza was not even an annexation. It was just a military administration for 19 years. So if Gaza is not Egyptian, and Gaza is not going to be entirely Israeli, but there's a heavy amount of Arabs, who's going to control it? Well, let the Jordanians take it. After all, Jordan is Palestine. It's all one big happy family. But you have to have security considerations. Therefore, Alon proposed annexing to Israel the southern half of Gaza. Granted, there are a lot of Arabs who live there, but they're mostly refugees who could be displaced. After all, they're displaced persons to begin with, so displace them again.
To where? To the northern part?
To other parts of the Jordanian state, whether the East Bank, the unannexed portions of the West Bank, or northern Gaza. Wherever, just not there. So that the Rafah crossing would not be a crossing between Jordan and Egypt, it would be a crossing between Israel and Egypt. All right. Now what about the bypass road? So you see there are three of them. One would connect Gaza with the Judean highlands for the Palestinians to be able to go one place to the other. Basically, the northern Gazans should have access to the rest of Jordan. Then a bypass road so that the Judean people in the Judean region of Jordan shall go be able to access the Jericho corridor and the rest of their country, and a bypass road for the Israelis to go from the northern Jordan Valley to the Judean desert, and that these roads would have sort of extraterritorial status, and you couldn't shoot anybody. Freedom of passage. What happened to this plan? How much of this plan ever became reality?
Zero.
Not zero. No, far from it. No. I would say more than zero. At least for a decade, the key element of not building civilian settlements in the densely Arab areas was adhered to, was official labor policy or unofficial labor policy. As for the Judean, Jordan River Valley being settled with a lot of Jews, or not a lot of Jews, but at least as many as would go, that happened. Okay, you have Jordan Valley settled. Not because it was out of the way. Economically, you're in a no man's land, so nobody really wanted to go. But there are people there. Was it annexed? No, nothing was ever annexed other than East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. But the idea that this is not going to remain Arab in the long run was accepted. What about Gush Etzion? Yeah, it was rebuilt. What about the Judean desert? That it remain in Jewish hands? A little bit yes, but a little bit no. I mean, to this day, it's not Area A or B. It's mostly Area C, even in the Oslo period.
I mean, Gush Etzion and Ma'al Adumim are the only places that were heavily settled.
Well, and now you have Ariel. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's it.
Yeah. Okay. So, on the issue of Gaza, what ended up happening? Well, This was a sore point because no one really wanted it. The Egyptians didn't want it. Not just that they weren't going to get it, they didn't want it. And Israel was willing to settle portions of Gaza, and at the high point there were about 8,000 Jews there, but the Jordanians never had a desire to take it. So all that was left was indigenous Palestinian rule that was not going to happen, because once the PLO was recognized as the official representation of the Palestinians, and yet Israel is at odds with the PLO and considers them a terrorist organization, you don't have much of a ready solution. Okay, so let's now get to the politics of the matter. In early 1968, the Israel Labor Party was established. The Labor Party, Avodah, which is today in the dumps, hardly exists anymore. But what was the Avodah? Avodah was a combination of the original alignment which was Mapai and Achduta Avoda, together with now adding Rafi. And they together formed the Labor Party, the Israel Labor Party. Why did this happen? Well, if you remember, Achduta Avoda wanted to get back together with the Mapai for a long time. And in 1965 they did an alignment, an electoral block. Although they were still two separate parties, they were in one electoral block, the original alignment. Rafi broke away precisely for this reason, because they disagreed with the alignment. David Ben-Gurion spouting venom at Levi Eshkol, Golda Meir, Moshe Sharet, all of his old chaverim, he had the worst possible things to say about them. And he disagreed with the Six-Day War. He was wrong, by the way. Ben-Gurion was totally wrong about what was going to happen in the Six-Day War. And his viewpoint after the war was much more dovish than most of the labor bloc. So he is not a good candidate to once again join with the Mapai. So how could Rafi join with the Mapai and form a labor party if David Ben-Gurion hates everyone's guts and doesn't want in? The answer is everyone else in Rafi joins the Mapai again and creates labor, and David Ben-Gurion is a lone holdout, a grumpy old man, sitting by himself in the Knesset as a one-man faction. So this was what happens. Now, why, from a Mapai point of view, from the perspective of Eshkol, Meir, Sapir, and the like, what's in their interest to bring Rafi back into the fold, even without Ben-Gurion, just with Dayan and Peres? Why bring them back in if there was such ill will for the past 3 years?
Numbers.
Okay. Okay, so the answer is, because after the war, Dayan was considered a big hero, and it was assumed that in the next election cycle, if he led a list or was on a list other than the Mapai list, the alignment list, then that list would get a big chunk of votes. The alignment could end up being diminished, so much so that who could win? Menachem Begin. Ever the specter of Menachem Begin winning the election is enough to scare the daylights out of people. So therefore, bring Rafi into an alignment, even if Ben-Gurion has to sit outside like the grumpy old man. So mostly because of Dayan's the aura of being a victorious hero. All right. In January of 1968, this is what happens. And as the Labor Party comes into existence, Golda Meir becomes the Secretary General of the Labor Party. She wanted the Mapam to be included in the Labor Party because she wanted a grand alliance of all the left-of-center factions. She was overruled by her colleagues, and so the Mapam remained separate, although a year later they would join a second alignment. In Israeli history, there's the problem is two alignments. There's the first alignment and the second alignment. They're both Ma'arach, the same name. But Mapam would join as a faction of the alignment a year later. And now it sounds like the left side of the aisle is pretty solid, and they're going ahead and going to win, and win for the foreseeable future. And they do, for two more cycles. But they have a problem. The problem is that Levi Eshkol is old and sick. He had a heart attack, he had cancer, he had another heart attack, they concealed it from the public. And the public doesn't know that he's going to die soon, but the insiders do know this. And Pinchas Sapir replaces Golda Meir as the Secretary General of the party when Golda retires at the age of 70. She says, I've had enough, I'm out of politics. Out of politics. Golda's done for. Elderly grandma, she wants to retire to the kibbutz and done with. 1968. So Golda is out. But Pinchas Sapir comes back there and says, Grandma Golda, you can't be gone so easily. We need you. Why? Eshkol is going to plot any minute. And we don't have a good candidate to replace him, because who are the two candidates? The two candidates are Dayan and Alon. Dayan is Rafi, Alon is Achduta Avoda. If either one of those two guys is selected as the replacement for Eshkol, the other side who loses will take their faction and bolt from the Labor Party and form a competitor list, and Menachem Begin could win the election. So therefore, we need not a centrist, but a Mapainik, a legitimate Mapainik, to be the successor to Levi Eshkol, so that neither of the two factions that are on the margins will ever walk away. And who must that be? You, Golda. It has to be you.
Why
it can't.
Sapir himself?
Ah, that's a good question. Ah, so Sapir did not want the job. He felt, and he admitted, I know finance, I know the economy, I don't know security, I don't know the bigger issues of society, I just know the money angle. And therefore he says, I'm an inappropriate candidate. Also, I like being the kingmaker. He didn't want to be the boss, he wanted to be the boss behind the boss. That suited him much better. So Golda is the logical choice. She would later present it as though she didn't know until after Eshkol died that this was going to happen, and that she was just satisfying the will of the party. Remember, in Israel, especially in labor Zionism, you're not allowed to have ambition. Political ambition is a bigger aver than Chilul Shabbos. Political ambition is for like Western imperialists. But among the comrades of labor Zionism, you do what the movement says you need to do. And you grudgingly accept when they tap you on the shoulder and say, it's your turn. Right? That's how it works.
It's so, like davening for the Yomud.
Exactly, like davening for the Yomud. So Golda would pretend like it wasn't really her thing, but they came to her and she said, we need you, so she said yes. Now, Eshkol knew how ill he was, and he also knew that some of the insiders were aware that his time was limited, and that Golda, who was not a member of the cabinet anymore. Remember, she resigned from the cabinet in 1966 after 10 years as foreign minister, was secretary general of the Mapai and then of labor, but that's behind the scenes role. She's at home now. So Eshkol said, and I'll use a dirty word in Yiddish, he said, these are exact words, that klafta is waiting at home for me to die. That's what was his exact words.
What's a klafta?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the truth is, their relationship was not so bad. It's just that she was waiting in the wings for him to expire. And he does. On February 26, 1969. When he dies, the replacement immediately is Yigal Alon as the acting prime minister for 3 weeks. Now, this is the case because Golda had arranged in 1968 that Alon be declared deputy prime minister. Now, what is a deputy prime minister? Basically means nothing, except for two scenarios. One, the prime minister is out of the country, and so you serve in an acting capacity while the guy is abroad. Or, someone dies or resigns, and there's an immediate vacancy, and so you fill in until such time as the cabinet can resolve, or the Knesset can resolve, who will be the leader of the next government, whether a caretaker government or a next cycle of elections. So the reason Golda did this was because of the two candidates, Dayan or Alon, she preferred Alon. Golda had a soft spot in her heart for the Achdut HaAvodah faction, and especially Israel Galili, who was the other leader of Achdut HaAvodah with Alon. She said about Galili, better Galili with no portfolio than four ministers with portfolios, meaning he was a great advisor. So she wanted that side to be more powerful than the Rafi side, because the Rafi side had been cursing her a blue streak for the past couple of years. And also, remember, in 1967, Golda had objected to Dayan becoming defense minister, and the public knew that. The public knew there was a certain measure of ill will between Golda and Dayan, and they would hold it against her once Dayan was considered a hero. Of course, once Dayan is the goat after Yom Kippur, that's all over. But for the 6 years that Dayan was a hero, it was a little bit of a resentment against Golda that she had stood in his way. Okay, so Alon is acting prime minister, but now the party has to vote. And the party votes by a score of 287 to zero, with 45 abstentions, that Golda should be the new prime minister. Who were the 45 abstentions? The Rafi faction. On March 17th, 1969, Golda presents her government before the Knesset, and the vote to approve this coalition government was a vote of 84 to 12 with one abstention. So who's the one abstention? David Ben-Gurion, who gets up from the rostrum and starts foaming at the mouth about how Golda is guilty of great moral defect. What was he referring to? The Lavon affair. Always the Lavon affair. Years and years after everybody was dead and buried from that affair, David Ben-Gurion was still fighting the old fight that wouldn't go down. Yeah.
Did
anybody ever bring up that that this is the first time a woman...
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned. I was about to say something. So in 1955, Golda ran for mayor of Tel Aviv, and she lost in a close vote. And the reason she lost was because at that time, Tel Aviv was a significantly religious city with Hasidim. Today, not, but I mean, that back then, it was a significant population. And so the Aguda and the Poale Aguda opposed her candidacy on the grounds that a woman cannot hold executive office. You know, Sroro, all these reasons why a woman can't be a president of a shul, whatever it is. So, with that in mind...
There's such a din?
Huh?
There's a din that a woman...
This is a history class, not a halakha class. So, I don't... there are dinim. There are dinim about Sroro, but whether it applies to a mayor or a president or a prime minister, I don't know. So what happens? So if they were opposed to her in 55, what are they going to say in 69? Are they going to oppose her again? Answer, what do you think is going to happen? No. There's a split between the Aguda and the Poale Aguda. Who says what? The Poale Aguda are in favor. Why? Because they're more moderate. They're not beholden to the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. And they say, oh, look in the Bible, the book of Shoftim, Devorah HaNeviyah. Golda is the new Devorah of our time. And the Aguda Yisrael faction says, no, a woman can't be prime minister.
You mentioned something about a vote, 84, 12, and 1.
Yeah.
Doesn't equal 120.
Yeah, people weren't there or didn't care.
Well,
you have to understand, when the government is voted in, a lot of times it doesn't add up to 120, because once they have above 61, it's a moot point. The opposition doesn't bother to vote.
Okay.
So the only ones who are really beholden to vote are the members of the would-be coalition,
right,
have to raise their hand and say yes.
Well, discipline.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Was there anything alone could do or try to do to keep himself in office?
No, because there were rules about how long an acting cabinet official can function, and the president had to tap a certain person to become the prime minister, and that person is going to be whoever the Mapai or the Labor Party puts forth as their candidate. So the Labor Party Central Committee had to vote on who they prefer. That person then gets tapped by the president, who was Zalman Shazar, and that person then has to assemble a coalition and then present it for approval before the whole Knesset. And that didn't take all that long in this case, because there wasn't any turnover in the coalition. It remained the same. Bear in mind the following. Levi Eshkol was only the prime minister. He wasn't a defense minister. So Diana's going to remain in place. Everybody else is going to remain in place. Golda was not even a cabinet member, so nobody has to lose their job. It's just one person dies and one person takes over for that one position. And so there was a lot of continuity. Golda maintains the National Unity Government, which she inherited from Eshkol, and she was very much in favor of it continuing indefinitely so long as it was viable, as it was practical. It would last another year and a half until August 7th, 1970, when, as a result of Israeli acceptance of the ceasefire to the War of Attrition and the Rogers Plan, Gachal would run away, saying that that Golda's government had been too conciliatory about giving up land in the territories. But that's for next week's session. Now, in the last few minutes that we have left, so I just wanted to mention what happens in 1969. Golda, as prime minister, is interested in cultivating good relations with the United States, and especially with President Nixon. They will develop a fairly good working relationship, and their tenures as president and prime minister are almost exactly the same. They overlap almost precisely. January 1969 as opposed to March 1969, and June 1974 as opposed to August of 1974. So she believes that she needs to be the person to negotiate with the United States. The need for American support is very acute, because the War of Attrition, which begins in April of 1969, is taking a heavy toll on Israel. The Air Force, even the Army. We could spend a long time on the military aspect of the War of Attrition, but we won't. Just to suffice it to say that the number of lives lost in the year and a half war of attrition was basically twice as great, or 1.5 times as great, as the Six-Day War. And this is not something Israel could sustain long term, to have this heavy of a fighting week after week after week, month after month. Israel was under great pressure, internally and externally, to come up with a solution to the problem. And that's where American intervention becomes so important. In the past, international intervention was seen as a problem. In other words, in the Six-Day War, Israel tried to delay a ceasefire as long as possible to acquire more territory. The longer the war goes, the better it is for Israel. The imposition of a ceasefire is a Soviet-Arab plot to stop Israel. In the War of Attrition, a ceasefire is a real need, but under what terms? And in next week's session, we're going to have to discuss, well, what did Israel want out of a ceasefire? What were the unacceptable terms that were too favorable to the Arabs or to the Soviets? It's a real question mark. But in 69, you have an election. So Golda is going to become the candidate for the prime ministership. She is prime minister. She took over to finish the term of Eshkol. But will she be the candidate in the fall elections? The answer is yes, she wants the job. What does the Labor Party do to secure victory? They join with the Mapam to create the second alignment. The thinking was that this alignment would obviate the need for a coalition government, that there had never been in the history of Israel, the 21-year history of Israel, a party with a majority of seats in the Knesset. There had never been. But once the alignment was created, they had 63 seats. 63, not bad. What would they do in the election? Would they retain a majority, an outright majority? That was the goal. And if that could happen, then alignment members would have all the ministries. Gachal would be out. Okay, you wouldn't even need the National Religious Party. All these other coalition members would be pushed out. And the Mapai, or the Labor alignment, would rule the roost. But it wasn't meant to be. Ultimately, the Labor alignment in the 1969 elections will win 56 seats, which is a heavy chunk, but it's down 7 from what they had before the election cycle. Why did they lose some seats? So next time we'll have to explain who was running against them, how did Gachal represent itself as holding up the right flank, what was the evolution of religious Zionism, and who were their voters in that cycle? And what did the far, far left have to say? Remember, this is the first election after the Six-Day War, and you have a significant percentage of anti-Zionists, whether Arab or Jewish communists, and they have a view of the territories that's very different even from the moderate doves in the Labor Party. So next time we're going to discuss the 69 election, the outcome, and social unrest in Israel in the early 70s. So stay tuned.